The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thanks to Andrew Loker for subbing in on the program yesterday and giving us quite a lot to think about with respect to God's work and all that we're preparing for. Some fascinating statistics as well in looking back over the past year. So if you didn't hear that program yesterday, it's, of course, posted at the trumpet.com website. The PAX coming up, we've got 63 now registered for Birmingham, and that will be happening in, about 4 weeks, three, 4 weeks. And then a few weeks after that, we'll be heading back up to Belfast, Northern Ireland, and we have 40 people registered for that one. So we can continue to pray for a good, strong showing in both of those upcoming personal appearance campaigns. Well, last night, President Trump responded to the Iranian siege on America's embassy in Baghdad, and he responded in spectacular fashion. He authorized the targeted assassination of the world's most wanted man, Qasem Soleimani. And along with him, he also killed, this was from a drone strike, right outside the Baghdad airport, not far from the U.S. embassy. But also killed in this drone strike was one of his top lieutenants in Iraq, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas, and then 10 others were killed in the convoy as well. As our Jerusalem correspondent Brent Nachtigall noted earlier today, we just posted the article at our website. But this was America's strongest, boldest action in the Middle East in more than a decade. You really can't exaggerate the significance of this targeted assassination. Killing Soleimani is like taking out the Iranian equivalent of Pentagon chief and CIA director combined. That's how he functioned for the Iranian government. This is much bigger than eliminating al-Qaeda's Osama bin Laden or the Islamic State's al-Baghdadi, which happened back in October. This was the kingpin of the Middle East. And it was Barack Obama who handed Soleimani the keys to the house, you could say. Shortly before the assassination, I mentioned it happened just outside of the Baghdad airport, Soleimani was flying in from Syria. He's just hopscotching all over the region. Touches down in Beirut, Damascus, Baghdad, Tehran. He's everywhere. He's like the Middle East viceroy. That's how important this individual was to Iranian interests. Of course, he's in charge of Iranian forces, or I guess the Quds force to be more specific. But he's in Syria before he lands in Baghdad. He's the one responsible for propping up Bashar al-Assad regime. So he's heading up the Iranian forces in Syria. He heads up the Iranian forces in Iraq. And he's just been bragging about it and getting more and more bold with each passing day. I mentioned Barack Obama. They reached the agreement on the nuclear deal back in July of 2015, as many of you will remember. And that deal, the important thing about that deal is it didn't just clear the way for Iran to build a bomb. It effectively handed control over the Middle East to this man that President Trump took out last night. Qasem Soleimani. That nuclear deal, they agreed on that in Vienna, I think it was, back in July of 2015. As many of you know, Obama's team signed the deal into action on January 16th, 2016. This is just a little over 3 years ago. So it's signed early on in January of 2016. And in that first year under the agreement, Iran increased its military budget by 90%. Not a 1 or 2% increase. 90%. So as head of Iran's Quds Force, this man, Soleimani, was swimming in cash. And he has been since 2016. A limitless budget. Even as ordinary Iranians are struggling to pay for food and fuel. Here is this man with no limit on his budget. Of course, swimming in cash. Obama's the one that gave him piles of cash, literally. They just set piles of cash on the tarmac in Tehran. Said, here you go. Here's hundreds of millions of dollars. And of course, by lifting the sanctions, it gave them access to billions and billions of dollars. President Trump, as we know, he blew up that agreement back in 2018. I'll talk in a moment about some of the events leading up to the dramatic events that we're seeing this week. But to just come back to this man and his authority, he's been over the Quds Force for 20 years, as Brent brings out in his article at thetrumpet.com. I mean, this man has had more to do with international terrorism than anyone on earth for the past two decades. Iran is the number one state sponsor of terrorism. He heads up all these militias around the region, in Iraq, as I said, Hezbollah, in Lebanon. He controls Hamas and the Islamic Jihad in Gaza. He presides over the Houthis in Yemen. And so here he is flying in on his plane, landing in Baghdad. And I mean, he's so powerful, and he was so convinced that the United States wouldn't do anything like this, that he's just operating more and more out in the open. He's not even in the shadows like most of the terrorists are. This is what Seth Franzman said at Jerusalem Post. It was only in the last 2 years that their dream of a Middle East dominated by Iran was reached. Now, we've been talking about this for decades as well. Iran dominating the Middle East. And they've achieved that dream just in the past few years. Franzman says they were arrogant. They had the kind of arrogance they accused the West of. No longer in the shadows, those like Soleimani and Mohandas came into the open. They acted like the heads of state. Their militias in Iraq appeared to dominate not only the security forces, but also the parliament. This is why ordinary Iraqis were protesting. They were protesting for Iran to get out of their country. They're tired of it. This article says in Syria, they built a network of bases from Imam Ali to T2, T4, and others. This network sought to move precision-guided munitions to Hezbollah in Lebanon. They were moving weapons through Iraq now because they had control of Iraq, then through Syria, all the way. They're, as we've written about in the Trumpet, they've built this corridor all the way through to the Mediterranean Sea. And here is this man, the viceroy, hopscotching all over the neighborhood, making sure Iran's wishes are carried out. This is the man last night that was targeted by the Trump administration. What led up to this? Well, in 2018, as I say, President Trump ripped up the nuclear deal that President Obama and Ben Rhodes were so proud of. They just loved that deal. That was their signature. Their signature foreign policy move, right at the end of the presidency for Obama. And since President Trump ripped it apart, Iran has been pretty pushy. We talked about their pushiness the other day, and this will continue. We'll talk some at the end of this segment about what we can look for next. I think Iran has to be jolted at the moment. I know there's quite a few saying that they could lash out, and I think even Melanie Phillips brings out the fact that they're still very, very dangerous. Everyone acknowledges this. But this represents a significant chunk of their leadership militarily. So they've, as you've heard from headlines over the past year, they've attacked Saudi oil infrastructure with missiles and drones. They've damaged oil tankers using sea mines. They shot down a U.S. drone, an American drone. They didn't take out a life in that attack, but they did take down a drone. I think the drone cost something like $200 or $300 million. They captured that British oil tanker. And then more recently, in recent months, these Iranian-supported militias in Iraq and elsewhere have been ramping up their rocket attacks on U.S. bases or in regions where there's a strong U.S. interest. And last week, December 27th, that's when they launched an attack, a missile attack, on a U.S. position in northern Iraq, and that's the one that killed the contractor and injured a couple of other Americans, I believe. And then finally, you could have argued that President Trump should have responded long ago. The drone gets shot down, really no response. The oil tanker damaged, no response. The attack on the Saudi oil fields, no response. No U.S. response. But finally, when an American life was taken out, this appears to be President Trump's red line. He does want to pull back. He does want to send the troops home. He doesn't want to spend money on wars. He doesn't want to go to war. He is a man with strong rhetoric. There's no doubting that. I think he's already tweeting today. But if you attack an American life, if you take out an American life, that appears to be his red line. And so he responded with some bombing raids on December 29th. I guess that would have been Sunday. I think three Iranian militia sites in Iraq, two sites in Syria. And then that's what led to the Iranians storming the embassy, the U.S. embassy in Baghdad on Tuesday. A two-day siege. They never got directly in the compound, as I understand. Well, they were inside the gates. They were burning things. They were vandalizing. They were painting things on the guard walls. Soleimani's our leader, they said. This is an attack on U.S. soil, a U.S. embassy. And then less than 48 hours after the siege, Soleimani was dead. And this is how ordinary Iraqis reacted in the streets just last night. Clip one. That was tweeted out, by the way, by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, that little video. Those are ordinary Iraqis cheering in the streets of Baghdad, waving Iraqi flags. They are happy to see this man go. They're happy to know that he's gone. And also, I'll let you in on another little secret that you're not going to hear in the media today. Ordinary Iranians are also celebrating, maybe not out in the streets, because they'd probably get killed for that. But they too are celebrating the death of this terrorist. Listen to Fareed Zakaria on CNN last night, what he's getting from his sources, clip 4.
I'm reading reports, for example, that talk about there's anger in Iraq because people think Iraqi government intelligence was provided to the Americans, which is almost certainly true, which is what made this strike possible. If that's the case, what that suggests is that the government of Iraq essentially helped to kill one of Iran's most important figures. And remember, Iran is also a patron. So this is going to get very messy very fast.
Now, CNN wants for us to believe that the people of Iraq are really upset by this. And to be sure, there's lots of Shia, there's lots of Shia Arabs in Iraq. And so they obviously have some support there. They've got all these Iranian militias that are just roaming the country. As I say, Soleimani's coming in and out of the country at will, just doing whatever he wants. He's the one that's intervening, not just militarily, but politically too, to make sure that the right guy's installed, the one that they want leading the nation. But you saw pictures there, ordinary Iraqis that just want to live their lives. They're happy to see individuals like this removed from the scene. Really, you know, the ones mourning the loss of Soleimani are the mullahs and the radical left. Those are the ones that are mourning the loss of this man. Melanie Phillips said this, "Whatever now happens, however, Trump has achieved something of incalculable benefit for America. He has got it off its knees. Donald Trump has gotten America off its knees," she says. "Faced with attacks on American assets, Jimmy Carter ran away. Bill Clinton prevaricated. Obama actually helped fund them. But Donald Trump ruthlessly and decisively killed the attacker. America is now back as a force to be reckoned with." There's your temporary resurgence. America is back, she says. Even the New York Times, for its part. "In killing General Soleimani, Mr. Trump took an action that Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama had rejected, fearing it would lead to war between the United States and Iran." So they had their opportunities, but they rejected this. And that's why Soleimani would just travel anywhere he wanted to go, feeling like he's untouchable. Because they firmly believed no one would ever go after the kingpin. And President Trump just did it. My father, remember in the Saving America article, he talks about a clear change in direction. This is clearly, it's clearly a change in direction. This was someone that Barack Obama didn't just appease or step aside and let him run his course. This is someone that Barack Obama helped. He admired Soleimani. He funded Soleimani. He even helped push ISIS back in a way that would help strengthen the position of Soleimani. He was working in tandem with Soleimani's forces when ISIS was making all the headlines years ago. What a clear change in direction we're seeing. You have a new administration that comes in and says, hey, this is a man who's responsible for killing, for murdering 600, at least 600 American soldiers. This is a man responsible for all of these terrorist attacks carried out by Hezbollah, the Houthis, Hamas, and others. This is a man who's been right at the center of the carnage in Syria. This is a man who hates America, who's been at a war. He's been at war with America for 2 decades. Iran's been at war with America for 4 decades. The Pentagon yesterday said General Soleimani was actively developing plans to attack American diplomats and service members in Iraq and throughout the region. You have all these liberal commentators today who said that this puts so many of America's diplomats in danger. In fact, he was working on plans to attack American diplomats throughout the region. And then the Pentagon says General Soleimani and his Quds force were responsible for the deaths of hundreds of American and coalition service members and of the wounding of thousands more. They said he had orchestrated attacks on coalition bases in Iraq over the last several months. He was just attacking right and left, over and again. And finally, America responds. If anything, one could argue that the Trump administration hasn't been strong enough in responding. But it's interesting to see the reaction in the media. This was talk about the media's reaction for a moment. This was a tweet that Farnez Fasihi, she's a New York Times reporter, she sent this out last night following the news of this man's assassination, and she sends out this rare video, as she calls it, of Soleimani reciting poetry in, I guess it would be Farsi. This is clip 3.
یاران همه رفتند، افسوس که جا مونده منم، حسرتا این گل خارا همه جا رونده منم، پیر ره آمد و طریق رفتن آموخت، آن که نارفته و جا مونده منم.
Do we know what her tweet said? I forget. Anyway, it's kind of interesting to see the way that there was that headline after Baghdadi was taken out where they, I think it was the Washington Post, referred to Baghdadi as an austere religious scholar, something to that effect. And then there were a few bizarre headlines just last night even. This woman that tweeted this out, she contributed to the feature story today. There's three journalists that are spotlighted at the top or that carry the byline. But if you look at the bottom of the New York Times featured article on the front page today, she's listed there. She helped contribute to this New York Times story. They can't believe that they have to walk a fine line here. Because they have to acknowledge that Soleimani was a ruthless killer. But at the same time, they hate Donald Trump, right? So this can't be right. This can't be the right course of action. And so that's what's led to a lot of the rhetoric last night and today, that this is surely going to trigger World War III. Well, at least they're talking about Iran in the same sentence as World War III. So let's give them some credit for that. But it's always, always, always going to be through the lens of Donald Trump surely can't be right, or what he's doing here is a horrible mistake. Listen to this Harvard professor. They bring out the Harvard professors, as you know, straight away. The Ivy League trained foreign policy gurus to tell us what's wrong with what happened here. This is from MSNBC last night, clip 5.
But all I've seen to date in their Iran policy is one-off actions, and this one-off action can have unbelievably horrific consequences.
And maybe that's the case, but we know from Bible prophecy that really the spectacular clash to look for is between Iran and Germany. It's not between Iran and the United States. Now, this lady used to work for the Obama State Department. The woman you just heard, Wendy Sherman, she went on to say this, clip 6.
Qasem Soleimani is a ruthless, ruthless killer. There is no doubt about that. Nobody weeps that he is gone as a person in what he did and the terror he brought about in the world. But that said, the Obama administration, at least to my knowledge, did not go after him and target him because we understood what the consequences were.
Listen to the reasoning there. She acknowledges that Soleimani's a ruthless, ruthless killer. He's the kingpin of the Middle East. He's presiding over all of these terrorist organizations. But because he's so ruthless, because he's so dangerous, she says Obama didn't go after him or target him because Obama knew what the consequences would be. So in that, basically, there's an admission that we know these people are horrible. We know what they're capable of doing. We know how they'll respond. And so we're just going to do nothing. We're going to give them free rein. We're going to give them piles of cash. We're going to let them do whatever they want to do. Because we surely don't want to make them mad at us. Well, they feed these terrorists. They feed off that kind of weakness. This is the only action that they really respect. Listen to this reasoning from, here again, they're not only Ivy League trained and educated, they're, so many of them, they're former Obama officials. Trotted out on the networks to tell us everything wrong about every decision, every foreign policy decision coming from the current administration. Here's Marie Harf. She used to work for, I believe, the State Department or the Pentagon. Clip 7.
There appears to be no strategy. He and his administration are ratcheting up the pressure on Iran, taking these very public airstrikes against Iranian-backed militias in Iraq. You know, the Israelis have been taking strikes against these same kinds of militias in Iraq and in Syria, but they're doing it more quietly.
I can't believe they're this educated. The Israelis, they carry out airstrikes as well, but they do it quietly. They blow up their bombs a lot more quietly than the United States. That's the reasoning. I guess it's, again, very public. By that, I suppose she means the tweets. It's okay to do some bombing, I suppose. Israelis do that. But just the approach that this administration takes, there's no strategy here. It's just kind of a random explosion. And then all of the tweets to go with it. Surely this can't be good. Well, we'll see. Ben Rhodes, for his part, he loved the nuclear deal with Iran. He said on Twitter last night, Trump may have just started a war with no congressional debate. I really hope the worst case scenario doesn't happen, but everything about this situation suggests serious escalation to come. So they're all warning us of serious escalation. And then he says, does anyone think Donald Trump is equipped to handle a complex, enduring international crisis that could play out in many countries and demand expertise, rigorous process, and judicious decision-making? That's Ben Rhodes, the architect of the worst foreign policy deal in U.S. history. This is what he said on MSNBC, clip 8.
And schizophrenic is the right description of the policy, Nicole, because Donald Trump likes to stand up and say that he's getting us out of these places, that he's pulling the troops out, that he's winding down these wars. But the reality is there are thousands more U.S. troops in the Middle East.
So he's schizophrenic. He can't decide if he wants troops here or wants troops there. But just know that he's not qualified for the job. Rhodes tweeted, no question that Soleimani has a lot of blood on his hands, but this is a really frightening moment. Iran will respond, likely in various places, and they may well respond in various places, but they've been doing it for years. Nonstop. Repeated. If anything, something like this can give them pause to think twice about whether they should lash out the way that they did. Listen to what we heard this clip last week and just kind of chuckled at the way the president said this. But when I got up to the news this morning, I immediately thought of this statement he made in Florida while he was on his vacation I guess, working vacation down there last week. Clip two.
Al-Baghdadi is dead. The leader of ISIS, the founder of ISIS, is dead. His replacement is now dead. And we have our sights on the new replacement. I don't know why anybody would want that job, frankly.
That's President Trump saying, I don't know why anyone would want to replace Baghdadi. They've already got his replacement. They took out Baghdadi in October. They've got the replacement out of the way. Last night, you've got Soleimani, one of his top lieutenants in Iraq. This is a serious blow to the leadership of Iran's military structure. But that doesn't mean the danger of the King of the South goes away, as we well know. Khamenei is calling for 3 days of mourning and saying there would be forceful revenge to come. And I thought this was an excellent point made by Melanie Phillips. It's similar to one that Brent made in his piece at The Trumpet. She says, the hitherto unthinkable U.S. killing of Soleimani, it was just unthinkable until last night, it may now spur all these people to redouble their efforts to bring the tyranny down. Even a mortally wounded serpent, however, can still cause death and destruction through the thrashing of its tail. So she says this could give momentum to the ordinary people of Iran to bring down the tyranny. But you also want to beware, even a serpent, interesting that she uses that analogy, the snake. We've called Iran the head of the terrorist snake. There is a mortal wound here, but she says it can still cause death and destruction, a wounded snake, through the thrashing of its tail. Now, Brent, in his article, he refers to the prophecy in Daniel 11, Iran's pushiness. And he makes this point. It's true that the Islamic Empire in Iran does have a fanatical end-of-days scenario where just provoking a worldwide war is enough to motivate their savior's return. However, Soleimani was not guided by war at any cost, a war at any cost scenario. He tempered his pushiness where and when he could be victorious. He had more of a military mindset. He was more strategic in the way that he pushed or when he decided to back off a little bit. But now that he's out of the way, as Brent brings out, now that Soleimani is dead, are we about to see a more reckless Iran? In the very short term, perhaps not, but looking ahead, knowing, like I even said the other day, here we are coming now into the fourth and final year of President Trump's first term. We're already almost through 1 4-year term. And if he comes into the second term, God really has the countdown clock on. God really is. And he really is heightening our sense of urgency. Here we are just a couple days into the new calendar year. And wow, already we've seen some dramatic events in Iraq. Soleimani described himself to a senior Iraqi intelligence official as the sole authority for Iranian actions in Iraq. He was telling people in Iraq, he was telling high-ranking officials in Iraq, I'm in charge here. Okay, look, we'll put the figurehead out there. We'll put this so-and-so prime minister, so long as the mullahs want it. But just so everyone knows, I'm the one running the show here. And as I say, he was openly mocking the U.S., the U.S. leadership. He tweeted out earlier in the year, we are near you. Where you can't even imagine. We are ready, he said. We are the man of this arena. Just taunting President Trump. Taunting the United States. And then they finally crossed the red line a week ago when they killed an American. That, for President Trump, is the red line. And he crossed it. And now he's no longer in the picture. Pretty dramatic developments coming out of the Middle East just today. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
I kind of alluded to this already in the first segment, but this targeted assassination last night, among other things, it represents a massive, massive blow to the Ivy League educated foreign policy establishment. This is just not the way you're to conduct yourself in the international arena. You can take out lesser figures. You can take out Baghdadi, okay, ISIS, everybody hates them. But now, Soleimani, that's a whole different ballgame. You can't go there. George Bush didn't go there. Barack Obama didn't go there. You can't go there because that is going to cause a worldwide explosion. That's what they're saying, and I played some of the clips for you in the first segment. All of these people making these statements, so sure of themselves, they're also very highly educated. Scholars that have worked for presidential administrations. People that have made millions of dollars because of their towering intellect. And why do these scholars, why do these Ivy League educated foreign policy gurus, why do they so often get it wrong? Not just wrong, tragically wrong. Well, it says a little something about how ideology can oftentimes blind people who are very intelligent, blind them to the truth, blind them to the facts, blind them to reason, sound reasoning. Victor Davis Hanson had an article at Town Hall yesterday or the day before. And he highlighted some of the spectacular failures made by these scholars coming from the radical left. He said the Washington Post recently published a surprising indictment of MSNBC host, Stanford graduate, and Rhodes Scholar Rachel Maddow. We went through that fifth installment of the Washington Post a week or so ago. But Rachel Maddow, she's Stanford-educated. She's a Rhodes Scholar. And Hanson says here, post-media critic Eric Wemple wrote that Maddow deliberately misled her audience by claiming the now discredited Steele dossier was largely verifiable, even at a time when there was plenty of evidence that it was mostly bogus. You see, blinded to the truth, blinded to the facts, blinded by ideology, they want so much for this to be true. It has to be, because that's what they've been educated to believe. It says, at the very time Maddow was reassuring viewers that Christopher Steele was believable, populist talk radio and the much-criticized Fox News channel were insisting that most of Steele's allegations could not be true, Maddow was wrong. Her less degreed critics proved to be right. Listen to this. In 2018, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Representative Devin Nunes, and the committee's then-ranking minority member, Adam Schiff, each issued contrasting reports of the committee's investigation into allegations of collusion between Russia and Donald Trump's campaign team and the misbehavior of federal agencies. It says, Schiff's memo was widely praised by the media. Nunes's report was condemned as rank and partisan. Many in the media went further. They contrasted Harvard Law graduate Schiff with rural Central California Nunes to help explain why the clever Schiff got to the bottom of collusion and the former dairy farmer, Nunes, was way over his head and had no idea what was going on. Well, he's just a dummy. He's just a farmer. He's not Ivy League educated. He can't be right. He needs to go back to his dairy farm. That's what the very educated leftists in the media were saying. It says here, recently, the nonpartisan inspector general of the Department of Justice, Michael Horowitz, found widespread wrongdoing at the DOJ and FBI. He confirmed the key findings in the Nunes memo about the Steele dossier and its pernicious role in the FISA application seeking a warrant against former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. In contrast, much of what the once praised Schiff had claimed to be true was proven wrong by Horowitz. From Schiff's insistence that the FBI verified the Steele dossier to his assertion that the Department of Justice did not rely chiefly on the dossier for its warrant application. It says when special counsel Robert Mueller formed an investigatory team, he stocked it with young, progressive Washington insiders, many with blue chip degrees and resumes. The media swooned. Washington journalists became giddy over the prospect of a dream team of such all-stars who would demolish the supposedly far less impressively credentialed Trump legal team. We were assured by the snobbish Vox that special counsel Robert Mueller's legal team is full of pros. Trump's team makes typos. Trump's team, they don't know what they're doing. It says, yet after 22 months and $32 million worth of investigation, Mueller's team found no Russian collusion and no evidence of actionable Trump obstruction during the investigation of that non-crime. All the constant media reports that bombshell Mueller team disclosures were imminent and that the walls are closing in on Trump proved to be false. He talks some then about Mueller's testimony during that congressional hearing. All the stars that were on his team, like Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. And then the older lawyers representing Donald Trump, like Ty Cobb and 78-year-old John Dowd, Jay Sekulow. And all these lawyers just told Donald Trump, yeah, go ahead, cooperate with Mueller. Give him what he needs to finish his investigation. You didn't do anything wrong. There's no evidence of wrongdoing here. And so, like Hansen brings out, it went on for 22 months. $32 million, all the thousands and thousands, subpoenas and tapping, investigating, and nothing. Nothing was there. It says, when the supposed clueless Trump was elected, a number of elites pronounced his economic plans to be absurd. We were told that Trump was bound to destroy the U.S. economy. Former Princeton professor and Nobel Prize winner Paul Krugman insisted that Trump would crash the stock market. He suggested that stocks might never recover. Former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers said Trump would bring on a recession within a year and a half. The former head of the National Economic Council, Stephen Ratner, predicted a market crash of historic proportions. In contrast, many of Trump's economic advisors during his campaign and administration, it says, were caricatured. Well, look at what the economy's doing 3 years on. This is how Hansen concludes. He says, the point of these sharp contrasts is not that an Ivy League degree or a Washington reputation is of little value, or, well, we might disagree with that even, but it says, or that prestigious prizes and honors account for nothing, or even that supposed experts are always unethical and silly. Instead, one lesson is that conventional wisdom and groupthink tend to mislead, especially in the age of online echo chambers and often sheltered and blinkered elite lives. We forget, he says, that knowledge can be found at all ages, in all places, and ethics has nothing to do with degrees or pedigrees. That's Victor Davis Hanson's latest on how the experts often get it so wrong, how that they're often way off. I'll just conclude this segment by going through a few verses that you're familiar with, many of you. There was another article recently in the National Interest. I'll just paraphrase a few of its points, but this is, the headline says, the founders never wanted an unaccountable deep state. So there's been this war going on. We've touched on it on this program. These unelected bureaucrats that just cannot stand that this president and his administration would break from established norms, that he would just chuck the status quo out the window. They cannot grasp that anyone would ever want to come along and do this, because this goes against everything that they've received from their precious education. So there's this war going on between the administrative state and the duly elected officials of this administration. And some that would say, well, we can't let this administration do away with what's so well established at the State Department, at the Department of Justice, at the CIA, at wherever. Well, this National Interest piece talks about how that the founders understood that power corrupts, and so there's all these checks and balances in place to prevent corruption from just spreading uncontrollably. It's in response, by the way, to Francis Fukuyama's essay recently. I forget the title of the more recent essay. He's the one that wrote The End of History back in the early 1990s following the collapse of the Soviet Union. And he was way off on his predictions back then as well. But it says here in response to Fukuyama's recent piece that the glaring gap in Francis Fukuyama's thinking is an inability to understand or even perceive the ongoing challenge of human nature, the one and only constant in history and politics. It says back in 1989, when he was musing about the ultimate triumph of Western-style liberal democracy as a final world phenomenon, just a fleeting look at the force of human nature, along with a cursory survey of world history, would have told him that such a prediction was utterly ridiculous. I mean, just a basic understanding of human nature. Just a basic grasp of history. should have informed him that his conclusions were dead wrong. It says, and today, as Fukuyama waxes eloquent about the role of the deep state in protecting democracy. See, he thinks that the deep state, the administrative state, that it's there to protect the democracy. So we just have to give these unelected bureaucrats all the power that they want so that they can protect us. It says that he waxes eloquent about the role of the deep state in protecting democracy from who knows what. We are well advised to question whether he has sufficiently taken into account the essence of human nature and the dangers it can pose when expansive power is unchecked. That's what we're seeing in these ever-growing departments, agencies that are supposed to be an extension of the executive branch. The president, in other words. But they have all of this unchecked power. And we see how that they abused that power. They abused it before President Trump came into office, and they continue to abuse it. He takes some bold, courageous action last night in Baghdad, this president. And here comes the same old people. All of these Obama acolytes, they come out in full force that night and then this morning to denounce anything and everything about this president. What was it that Ben Rhodes said? Does anyone really think that this president is capable of handling this or any given situation? That was the gist of it. Here it is. Does anyone think Donald Trump is equipped to handle a complex, enduring international crisis that could play out in many countries and demand expertise, rigorous process, and judicious decision-making? That's for the experts, Ben Rhodes thinks. Not Donald Trump. He's not educated enough. His team, they're not educated. They're ignorant. They don't know what they're doing. That's why they all sound like a broken record. Well, there's just no strategy here. There's no plan. And then it's this dangerous course of action that could cause World War III, they say. All the experts. We'll see how it plays out. You're on more stable ground, much more so stable. If you just, as we discussed earlier in this week, if you just view the events of this world through the lens of Bible prophecy, that's what keeps us on a sure foundation. Your Bible says in Jeremiah 17:5, cursed be the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm or his strength, and whose heart departs from the Lord. Cursed is the man who puts his faith, his trust, his confidence in human ability, human intellect, modern education, you could say. It's not just that they get things wrong over and over again, but like we've pointed out so many times before, even after they've been proven to be wrong, there's no contrition. There's no humility, which shows really what is underlying those kinds of lofty degrees, that kind of scholarly education. It's vanity. It's vanity. They have to be right. They can't admit that they're wrong. And so they go forward, blinded by ideology, blinded by their bias. Verse 9, it says, the heart, they go forward with this kind of heart too. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Who can know the human heart? You see, you heard an admission was implied in some of those clips we played earlier that, well, now we will acknowledge that Soleimani is a ruthless killer, that he has killed and murdered hundreds and hundreds of people. We will acknowledge that. But look, that's why we never went after him, because we didn't want to make him upset. We didn't want to make him upset. Well, he's been filled with rage from the beginning, carrying out all of these violent acts all over the world. the number one state sponsor of terror, the number one terrorist in the world, the most sought-after terrorist in the world. And yeah, if you look at the problem with modern education today, I mean, what it says or teaches about human nature, it's that you can basically sit down and talk with someone like that and shake their hand and then come away from it knowing that you can trust them. Man's been making the same mistake over and over and over again. In my father's booklet, the Jeremiah booklet, it says, understanding this profound verse, Jeremiah 17:9, is more important than any education in this world. If you understand this one verse, you are well on your way to becoming truly educated God's way. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us all week, and we'll see you next week.